I'm Indy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Today we discuss psychological themes in movies and books, and there are many, many examples. Dan put together a little montage of some classic moments.
Here's Johnny.
You talking to me? You talking to me? You talking to me? Well, then who the hell else are you talking to? Talking to me? Well, I'm the only one here.
You play very well.
Oh, yeah? So do you. Oh, God, what a dumb thing to say, right? I mean, you say it, you play well, and then right away I have to say you play well. Oh, God, Annie. Well, oh, well. La-di-da, la-di-da, la-la, yeah.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen.
And under no circumstances, tell my sister the contents of this note. It's not me that needs a Dr. Blanche.
So what am I supposed to do? You won't answer my calls. You change your number. I mean, I'm not going to be ignored, Dan.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. Beyond it is another dimension. A dimension of sound. A dimension of sight. A dimension of mind.
Joining me, psychologist Michael Abruzzese and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Mindy.
Okay, well, just in case people are wondering, we're going to talk about some of these movies. Psycho, The Shining, Taxi Driver, Annie Hall, Hitchcock, of course, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, a classic, Fatal Attraction, and a little clip there from a TV show, Twilight Zone. I guess, you know, when you think about psychological themes in movies, Alfred Hitchcock always comes to mind because he was like the master, wasn't he?
Oh, certainly. Yeah. He had the art down.
Yeah, he sure did. There was Susan Krause Whitborn is a professor of psychology at UMass Amherst, and she wrote a piece for Psychology Today about psychology's best movies. And she writes, underneath the glitz and the glamour, psychology provides much of the substance that propels producers, directors, and screenwriters to give creative voice to the range of human experiences. This is interesting. She notes the Academy Awards are heavily weighted toward films that depict psychological themes. They also give unusual emphasis to certain types of characters and issues. She writes, here I've compiled a list of psychological themes in award-winning movies, including movies that won Best Leading Actor, Best Leading Actress, Best Picture. This led to a potential set of 252 films and characters. And she says of those, she counted 62 that fit her criteria, leading to the overwhelming statistic that psychology accounts for 25% of all Oscar-winning major films and roles. And she says, it is possible I missed one or two. But that's not a surprise, really,
no,
right?
No,
I mean, that's,
no.
We're talking about life.
Now, I hope some people call in about some of their favorite movies and what it depicts for them. But I think one of the benefits of having an art form like movies is that it really can, if people pay attention, it really can give viewers an insight as to what it's like to have some of these psychological conditions. Unfortunately, maybe some of the people who should know about this don't bother to watch the movies. But in terms of professionals who are on the periphery, you know, physicians who deal more with the medical side, is less for the psychological side and refer out, or people in their front office, law enforcement, things like that. People who haven't had the experience of a major depressive disorder or haven't had the experience of a reactive psychosis, they really have no relational database with which to compare it. So some of these movies, when they're well done, really can explain quite a lot to people and give some insight.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, we are visual animals. We process a lot of information visually, and that's why I think movies have such a big impact.
Right.
We can, I suppose, the art in it is effective communication of empathy of one human to another. And when we see something, we can really kind of get into the skin of the actors.
Right.
And that's their skill, is to invite us in there.
Yeah.
Really appreciate what is going on. And that's what interests us.
Yeah, it's interesting you're talking about being visual, because we also are talking about books this morning.
Yes.
And I was looking down a list of you know, some books that somebody had put together as the best. And many, many of them have been made into movies. I guess
that's
no surprise
right.
there.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. And even when you read, you are visually imagining what the
sure.
scene is.
Yeah. If you have a favorite or a book or a movie that really made an impact on you, share. 866-999-4626. 866. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. I know I've told you guys this story when we thought about doing this topic, but there was a book I read in the 1970s called Till Death Us Do Part. Vincent Bugliosi, who of course was the prosecutor in the Charles Manson case, but this was a case before that where he was seeking the death penalty on a murder case or a couple murders that was on circumstantial evidence. No weapon, no eyewitnesses, and the book was really legal, but the guy, the sociopath that was on trial here, you know, I read this, and this was a former L.A. cop, and everybody loved him, and he had murdered his girlfriend's husband for the insurance money, and then when that ran out, he attempted the same thing with his wife. He had a first wife who actually lived through some murder attempts. But that had such an impact on me just reading about this character, this guy, because I thought, wow, this is half a dozen guys I know. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, this was a real, you know, attractive, likable. Sure. Even once he went on trial, there was this group of people and no, it couldn't, like, right. This couldn't be right. Yeah. And I thought, okay. I didn't go on a date for months. It freaked me out. Sure. Well, so it can really have an impact.
There are a lot of fans, yeah. Really, of Ted Bundy.
Exactly. That's true. The same kind of
thing.
That's
true. Yeah. Now, maybe you two can help me out, because there was one movie that I wanted to mention. Of course, I've forgotten the name. I can tell you the whole plot and who was in it, so I will. Because it's a great depiction of what happens as the sequelae, the results of childhood physical and sexual abuse. Nick Nolte was in it. Willem Dafoe was in it. And they had an abusive dad who won, I think, Best Supporting Actor, and I was trying to think of his name. It'll come to me. But it's a depiction of how one of the boys became very, very reactive and became a local town sheriff, and his brother just sort of became very quiet, very taciturn, hardly ever spoke, and then just went on his own way and only visited the family. And the daughter became, I guess, what some people would describe as a holy roller, a very devout religious person. And the long-suffering mother remained in the relationship. And I really want to mention this movie because we're getting a note saying it's Affliction.
Affliction. Right?
So I would recommend anyone see this movie because it really is an excellent example of the extremely subtle, unknowable kinds of conditions that really afflict people, mm-hmm. and how it changes their lives, and how the ripple effects changes the lives of other people that they interact with, ruins relationships with your kids, makes it difficult for you to have a relationship with a significant other, and I was really struck when I saw the movie because I don't think I'd ever seen a movie that really depicted kind of like the undercurrents of under the water of what's going on with that. So I'd recommend that. That's a good depiction of what happens. I guess you'd call it PTSD, but it's mostly the results of physical and sexual abuse.
Yeah. Well, when you mentioned PTSD, what comes to my mind so visually is In the Deer Hunter.
Oh, my gosh, yeah.
That was such a gripping movie. But there's the scene of the soldiers going back to Vietnam and playing Russian roulette in a highly emotional scene. Really, to kind of get themselves high again off the violence,
right.
And it still sends chills down my spine visualizing that scene.
And you know, you wonder too when you're watching some of these films if you don't have any really knowledge of whatever the psychological disorder that's happening, you know, schizophrenia, I'm thinking of A Beautiful Mind. You don't know how accurate that portrayal is, right. You know, if you're not a doctor, let's say. But going to A Beautiful Mind, that was one that I know you didn't like it as much as I did. Mm. I loved that. I thought that was fabulous. And I thought it was, you know, just like that insight and those characters that you thought were real that he's talking to that don't exist.
Exactly.
And I really felt like we really got into his head and really got a sense of what life was like for
him. My objection with that kind of film is simply because it's almost impossible to show on the screen. So you have to have other people. When the character who's having a kind of hallucination is speaking to someone, there are different ways to photograph it, to film it. But the people who choose to film it as though they were speaking to another person and they show another person there really think is very misleading because the person who in hallucinations are not uniform, but a person who's having a visual hallucination may not actually see someone over there. So it's a little bit of a misnomer that people who are schizophrenic, who hallucinate and who speak to other people or who think out loud in a certain direction of the room, actually visualize someone there. I think a much more effective methodology would be to just have the camera on the person speaking to someone as though they were speaking,
mm-hmm.
and then maybe have the camera move away at the end of the movie and see that they're speaking to empty space.
Right.
I think that might have. So my complaint
is your beef was with the filmmaking,
yeah,
not with the story.
Yeah, it was how they sort of manifest that. Not
yeah,
the
because
film.
That was also a book, and yeah. Probably the book was much better. I didn't read the book, but yeah. I imagine the book was probably, as most cases, better than
right.
the movie.
Right. Yeah, I can see your point. There's a disadvantage, which is what you're pointing out, because most probably the psychotic individual does not experience a fully organized visual image
mm-hmm.
Like is depicted. But the advantage to doing it that way is that it really does put – but the viewer is only going to appreciate a fully organized visual image.
Mm-hmm.
And the advantage to doing that is it does get it speaks to the viewer. It might not be the accurate portrayal of what the actual perception is in the psychotic individual's head, but it speaks to the viewer in a way that they can relate
right,
to what's going on.
Yeah.
And that's what was excellent about that film.
Yeah,
right. In a similar vein, again, I can't think of the title on this, but it has Kevin Costner in it as a serial murderer. Maybe someone can help us out with the title on
Dan,
this.
Dan, who's seen every movie on the planet. Maybe.
And William Hurt was his doppelganger, and it talks about how he really about goes into the mind of a serial killer who's not very flashy, doesn't have any intention of getting caught, and it really has the same kind of depiction. Mm-hmm. He is speaking to his other self, who's not there. William Hurt plays his other self, and he's not there. Oh, that's right. Mr. Brooks, that's correct. Yeah. Yes, thank you.
Well, we got a crack team in there.
Certainly
so I'd recommend you take a look at Mr. Brooks as well as Afflicted, because in Mr. Brooks, you definitely see how the mind works on that. Mm-hmm. And there's enough of a flash in to the other character and a flash out to the to the inward state of the person as he talks about. And I think that probably is an accurate depiction of how many, not that I would know, but how many serial killers or people who have a severely psychopathic a personality who, when it results in murder, approaches things as opposed to someone just getting a gun and exerting itself in a mass murder like we've had recently. It's much more subtle, and I think it's much more prevalent than the flashy mass murdering
right, yeah. goes on. When you're talking that, right away I thought of Silence of the Lambs, which I have never seen, by the way. Have you watched it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, and it was just, I just couldn't do it. It just seemed too gruesome to me. I was like, I don't know. But, you know, and it was interesting. Yesterday I'm trying to help Dan with some of those clips for that montage we played at the top, and I was looking for that, hello, Clarice. But he never says that in the movie. Mm-hmm. That's a misnomer. He says, good evening, Clarice. but that's like a classic line that never happened, right?
It's like, play it again.
Yeah, exactly, right? Yeah.
Well, so, I didn't see the second installment because I read the review on that. I said, no, I don't want to see that. I don't want to see that.
Sequels are never as good as the first.
Yeah, but the first one I thought was actually relatively good. But again, I had some difficulties with the total portrayal of the psychotic character. And I think in a previous show, we talked about the difference between sociopathic and psychopathic. Mm-hmm. And I think he was more of a psychopathic person. I think they tried to portray him in the book as a sociopathic person, which is a dimensional difference. I think Mark and I may have a different theoretical perspective on that. Some people do. But a psychopath, in my definition, is someone who doesn't care about anyone else, including themselves. And a sociopath is someone who doesn't care about anyone else except themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So the psychopaths would be, for example, the people who do murder-suicide, or they would engage in terrorist bombing, suicide bomber, where the sociopath is a person who would manipulate these people into doing such a thing. So they don't get hurt, but they destroy as many other
people
possible.
Away. Yeah. What do you think about that?
I think that's probably accurate. It's probably in our language. I think they're blurred.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. So in the Silence of the Lambs, I thought that he would fit into either one of the categories, but I would call him more of a...
Boy, Anthony Hopkins really did look like he was... I mean, what a good actor he is. Yes. To scare me enough to not even watch the movie.
Right.
You're listening to The Point. We're talking about movies and books with psychological themes with psychologist Michael Abbruzzese and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. Let's talk to Jeannie, who's giving us a call from Oak Bluffs. Hi, Jeannie.
Hi, how are you this morning?
We're great.
Well, movies are my passion, and since single digits, and one movie I'm lucky enough to vacation on the Vineyard every year, and one movie I saw 2 years ago ended up being my favorite of the year, and it was Sarah's Key.
It was what?
Sarah's Key.
Sarah's Key.
Sarah's Key. What's it about?
Well, it's about a little girl who it goes back and forth between modern times and World War II. And it's about a little girl and her apartment in Paris. It's about the people in Paris during World War II who were sent to concentration camps. And do you want me to tell you the plot?
Well, maybe not the ending, but so is it sort of a survival kind of a film, and what they went
through? She survived. Her little brother is not swept up from the apartment, and she survives, and she ultimately ends up doing away with herself because of what has happened in the fact that her brother was left in the apartment all those years, and she survived the Holocaust.
Yeah, that sounds okay. Well, we'll put that one on the list. It's called Sarah's Key. All right,
Sarah, like S-A-R-A-H.
Yep, Sarah's Key. Great. Jeannie, thanks. Thanks for contributing to our list.
Well, it also contributes a major category.
Category, right.
And that is the psychological films having to do with survival in the Holocaust, say, survival during extreme environments.
Yeah. And also, as she was talking, I was thinking, you know, when she mentions that the lead character eventually commits suicide, and that made me think of The Others. Have you seen The Others? This is kind of a movie is it World War One or World War Two? I can't really remember, but she lives in this, it's Nicole Kidman, she lives in this house with her children, and they have this light disorder, so they always have to make sure the drapes are drawn when they go from room to room, and she's very particular, and one of the kids sees ghosts, or he talks to a ghost, and you know, this has got Nicole Kidman kind of freaked out, her character, and I'm going to ruin it, so if you don't want to know the end, close your ears.
Spoiler alert.
Yes. Yeah. Come to find out, it's Nicole Kidman and the children who are the ghosts, and she has killed the children and herself when her husband is lost at war. It's a very intense, but I really, it's one of those movies you went, oh!
Yeah, that's really a movie with a shocking ending.
Shocking ending,
You know, that similar to The Sixth Sense.
Yeah, that was another great one,
Again, I thought that was an exception to my complaint about how badly filmmakers do this, except for that one scene where it looked pretty clear that the woman was speaking to the star of the show. And that really wasn't the case, and I think that was deliberate on the part of the filmmaker.
Yeah, to make us think
like a misdirection kind of thing.
It puts you in the skin of the person who has the experience, and that's what we want from movies.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. So I think they're both examples. This Sarah's Tea, an example of maybe survivor's guilt or post-traumatic stress disorder.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and you wonder why someone who had gone through such horrific experiences and survived would actually take their lives. Again, it's the undercurrents of people's lives. I mean.
Right.
People don't wake up in the morning with nothing going on. They wake up in the morning with their entire life having gone on before them.
Right.
And just because someone has survived a horrific event does not mean that they have come out unscathed. There's a big difference.
Right? That's right. Or the world is different for them.
And it's really inspirational, too, when you see some of these things that some people have, you know, especially some of these movies that are based on true stories or documentaries for that matter. When you see what people have been able to survive and go through, it really makes you pause and reflect about your own life and think, you know, how lucky you really are.
And wondering what you do in those shoes.
Exactly. Yeah. Would you act the same way? Right. How would it impact you? I know it's really that raises a lot of questions.
Right.
Helen's giving us a call from Eastham. Hi, Helen.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I tuned in a little late. I don't know if you mentioned two of my absolute favorites, Vertigo and Rear Window.
We did mention Alfred Hitchcock, but we didn't get specific. Mm-hmm. But he was the master, wasn't he, Helen?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
The psychological success.
What did you like about those?
Well, the obsession of the Jimmy Stewart character with the Madeline figure and then attempting to recreate her into the former image, I found fascinating as just a guy right over the edge.
Right.
And another one of my favorite is Rear Window because of the voyeurism. This character is immobilized in a bedroom because of a broken leg, I think.
It's another obsession.
Yeah,
he's obsessed with.
And I think Alfred Hitchcock did have his share of obsessions himself.
Oh, well. Apparently with blondes, I understand.
All day about him.
His leading ladies.
One of my favorites, movies was a French movie that was remade, Diabolique, a French movie that was out maybe 20 years ago and was remade with Sharon Stone and Isabelle Huppert. I don't know if any of you have.
No, I haven't seen that.
Where it's again a sort of obsession. It's a takes place in a boys' school, and Sharon Stone is a teacher, and the wife of the headmaster is being abused by the headmaster, and the two women take it upon themselves to get rid of the husband. And it's just done so subtly, though, so much of it with just visual exchanges, and you almost root for them because he's such a jerk. You know, the audience being a willing participant in the bad acts, just like in Psycho. You want that car to get down. You want Norman to get away with it. You know? Brings out the worst in us, I guess.
Oh, Helen, thanks. Those are great suggestions. Thanks for putting those on the list.
And about obsessions, the relatively more recent one was American Beauty.
Oh, right.
Kevin Spacey being so enthralled and obsessed with a prepubescent or barely pubescent young girl was just fascinating. And what he lost, the addictive quality of that obsession.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
I think about all the movies that Helen had reminded us in Diabolique. I thought about also the movie 9 to 5 that many people might remember with
Dolly Parton.
Dolly Parton where they, I think they either accidentally or on purpose kill their boss because he was such a jerk. But it called about three different kind of personality types that clearly you often see in workplaces, co-workers, stuff like that. Yeah. I think it's a decent depiction of the times at that back then.
Yeah, we've got some posts on our Facebook page. Three Faces of Eve.
Oh, yeah.
Of course, Joanne Woodward. Oh, this was one that we talked about before we went on there. Memento. That was an intense film. Mm-hmm. And that was about a man who suffers from retrograde amnesia. So he can remember long-term, but short-term memory not. And so he uses notes, tattoos, and to try to hunt for the man that he thinks killed his wife. This was interesting because this was like, when it first released, really nobody really knew anything about it, but it was like a art film, $5 million, and went on to be one of the top 10 highest grossing films. I think it was what year was that? 2000. But that's one that's you got to pay attention because it's got the black and white and the color, and you're kind of you start at the end of the story, and so you've got to really pay attention. It's a one of those films that leaves you at the end asking more questions than
Well, it certainly brings home how important memory is.
Yes,
to our existence.
Of course, exactly. Yeah,
there's a movie somewhat in that vein is with Denzel Washington a few years ago called Deja Vu, and it at the end it really seems to be more of a science fiction movie because it turns out that some of his thought lapses and his memory lapses, very similar to an amnesic sort of remembering bits and pieces of their past. But that also talks about the experience of what it's like to think you see something and it looks familiar and it's not familiar to you. And if they didn't have the science fiction twist or the ending, I think it would be a very good depiction, as Mark's talked about, how important memory is, what happens when you start to lose a little bit of your memory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And there's a movie that you've seen. We're going to current day now, Blue Jasmine.
Blue
and that's one, when we were talking about movies yesterday, somebody else in the newsroom brought that movie up. Oh, so tell us about that.
Well, it's a terrific movie. It's about a woman who was flying high, was married to a narcissistic sociopath, apparently, who cheated people out of money, basically. Mm-hmm. But she lived on Long Island, in the Hamptons and in New York City and a house somewhere else, maybe in France, and had, a high-flying social life. And he got prosecuted. He collapsed. So the government took all of her money and she lost everything. And she went out to Los Angeles to live with her sister, who was a bit of a hippie. And at any rate, it really portrayed the shallow, one-dimensional aspect of people that can be shallow and one-dimensional, and how devastating it was, and how devastating it was to others because of her effect on others. It's beautifully done. You get right in the skin of this woman, of how anxious and scared she is about everything, because she defined herself by possessions only. And this could be applied to America nowadays. Sure, materialism.
Right. I had heard that was supposed to be one of Woody Allen's best films.
I wouldn't be surprised.
Well, Woody Allen really does have a way of, you know, I mean, and sometimes of that very humorous side, right. Of course, of you know, our emotions. We did have a clip from Annie Hall, and mm-hmm. Annie Hall was quite the anxious character. Yeah. So it showed us a little bit about anxiety.
Absolutely. Well, he's so good at depicting relationships and how they go wrong in certain aspects, where they go wrong, just a wonderful artist that way, regardless of his own personal faults.
Well, Joel says, Psycho, or any movie with a rocking chair that rocks by itself.
And the question is, why would that be disturbing?
We're talking about movies and books with psychological themes. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And you know, we've got some, I went around the station here and we got some staff picks, which are the same, some of the same ones that are up on our Facebook page that people put. One Up Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, of course, a classic. You know, Jack Nicholson is in a lot of these, what was the,
As
Good As It Gets, mm-hmm. The Shining. Yeah. I mean, you know, he can play a great crazy person, can't he?
Oh, he's wonderful. Yeah.
But As Good As It Gets was really a good movie. That's right. If you haven't seen it, that's worth seeing.
Yeah. Right. That has three characters, and all three of them seem to have have a lock on different psychological, you know, behavioral issues. Yeah. And I think they all do a very good job in portraying all of them.
Yeah, exactly. Let's see. Another one we've got suggested here is, a question. Could Anna Karenina have been bipolar?
Well, interesting story about Anna Karenina. I mean, I think it could be. It could be. I tend to think more of a narcissistic personality disorder, or maybe a dissociative aspect of that. But, I mean, it's when you get to conditions like a bipolar and then some of the more esoteric personality disorders, it's really hard to tease those out. Really hard to tease those out. So the question is, what kind of experience did the author have with people that he would write that character?
Yeah.
Certainly Scarlett O'Hara was a narcissistic person.
Oh, yeah. Gone with the Wind. Yeah, for sure. That's a great example. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I was just thinking when you what was the name of the movie that Colin Firth was in, the King Who Stuttered?
The King's Speech.
The King's Speech. Yeah. That was, I thought, fantastic. Oh, yeah. Now, I don't... Mm-hmm. You know, I don't have that issue, but it seemed like it was pretty spot on, was it?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
I think so.
He did a fantastic job in that. He
certainly did. Yeah. And just the agony of somebody who stutters.
Yeah. And to be in that position, and have to speak to your people.
And yet he rose above it all and brought the country through World War II.
Debbie is calling from Vineyard Haven. Hi, Debbie.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Oh, sure.
I'm a movie freak and a former therapist.
So
right up my alley. I think Robert Redford's Ordinary People is one of the best.
That's a good one too.
Yep.
Yeah,
one of the absolute best. All of the incredible dysfunction in the family, the suicidal kid, the emotionally unavailable mother, the how much was triggered by the death of the other brother, and how much was the dysfunction in the family anyway. I found it fascinating and incredibly beautifully acted by everybody.
Yeah. I think that was one of the first ones that really portrayed family dysfunction. And so, in your face.
So well. Well. Another one really briefly, and I can't remember the name, the one about a plane crash with Jeff Bridges, Isabella Rossellini, and I can't remember the other actress's name, but they have a plane crash and it's the effect of that on their lives, totally transforming their lives. They survived this devastating plane crash. Don't remember?
No, but I think our crack team in the control room there is working on it.
Yeah, and is going to know it. It was a great movie.
Yeah. Fearless? What are they saying?
Fearless, yes.
Fearless, okay.
Yes.
There you go. All right. Thanks, Jenny. Fearless.
They're batting 1,000 in there.
Yeah, I was going to say, Debbie, you'd be all day going, what was that movie? Yeah. Thanks for adding to the list, Debbie. We appreciate that.
Thank you.
I think when she mentioned Ordinary People, I think people forget really what a terrific movie that was on so many levels. A lot of people have forgotten about it. Mm-hmm. I think it has one of the first accurate depictions of what it's like in most psychotherapy sessions. Mm. And certainly, again, we're talking about the undercurrents. I think the reason he called it Ordinary People is because they quite certainly knew that you don't have to have a lot of bones sticking out of your body to have broken bones. I mean, and you don't really have to have something totally dysfunctional that spills over into alcoholism or gambling addiction or something like that to have a very dysfunctional life going on and no one else knows it. Yeah. This really is a great film. People should probably watch it in our field. Graduate school students should watch it every year, I think.
We could make a list, right?
Yes. Right.
Tom is calling from Dennisport. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, sure.
One of my favorites is Blue Velvet, and the way it puts you in like a voyeuristic position to observe Dennis Hopper's madness.
Mm. I haven't seen that one. What's it, tell us the storyline.
You've never seen Blue Velvet?
No, I haven't seen it.
Well, this kid's walking to see his father in the hospital, and he comes across a human ear, and then he brings it to a detective, and the detective is like, thanks for help, Jeffrey, but leave the detective work to us. And instead, he goes about trying to figure out everything himself. He's in the woman's apartment when Frank Booth, who is Dennis Hopper's character, comes in, and it's just amazing. But pretty terrifying.
Well, I was going to say, yeah, Jenny saw it, like she says, 10 times. So scary. She said she's scared just thinking about it.
Well, we should put that on our list, though. Let's take a look at
that. It's also really entertaining, the way David Lynch films it.
Oh, good. How old is this movie? Is it an older movie?
86.
Oh, okay, 86, thereabouts. Okay, great. I'll definitely check that out.
I don't know if you've ever heard of The Girl at the End of the Lane.
Oh, yes, I have heard that one.
Mm-hmm. Jodie Foster and Martin Sheen.
Yep, that was I did see that years ago. That was a scary one too. Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. Girl at the End of the Lane, right on my list. Okay, great. Thanks, Tom. Thanks for those. Are good, good examples.
Well, while we're talking about that, Tom's comment about The Girl at the End of the Lane reminds me of that trilogy: the girl who played with fire, the girl who kicked over the hornet's nest. Do you folks see?
Oh yeah, the Stieg Larsson, is that his name?
Right. They had the Swedish versions and the American versions on that, and I think that clearly talks about. That talks about so much psychopathology and so many of the characters over there. And this girl actually seems to come out of it about as well as she possibly could have.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. Or better than anybody could
have. Yeah, better than it, certainly, yeah.
Exactly.
She triumphed.
You're listening to The Point. We are talking about movies and books with psychological themes with psychologist Michael Abbruzzese and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. 866-999-4626 is our toll-free number. Our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. Movies, books for therapy?
Oh, well, you know, I find it a very good avenue to get to know people when they talk about a movie or a book that they've read. Mm-hmm. And it just ask them, I may not have even read or seen the movie, but ask them what it is they related to. And the parallels between what they related to, it's like a Rorschach, really, what they related to and how they discuss it is very telling about what is on their mind, what bothers them. I think you find a lot of therapists that suggest books, usually the self-help type, but novels are wonderful theme expanders.
Yeah, well, I was going to say, I wonder what we can read into some of my coworkers here with some of their choices, right? Anything Oliver Sacks. She said, the man who mistook his wife for a hat in particular. It is in fiction, but it's very interesting.
Yeah, he
is a very interesting guy.
He's fascinating, yeah.
The Yellow Wallpaper by Charlotte Perkins Gilman. And The Bell Jar, Sylvia Plath, of course, another classic.
That's right.
All right, we've got a few calls here. Kyle is calling from Falmouth. Hi, Kyle.
Hi. Winterbone.
Winterbone?
Winterbone.
I don't know that one. What's the story?
About a young woman who's... in a meth environment in the Ozarks. It's fabulous. Survivor.
Okay.
Survivor
film. Okay.
Survivor film. Yeah.
Yeah, those are great. Mm-hmm. Survivor films. Kyle, thanks. Appreciate that.
Sure.
Good suggestion. All right. Jane is calling from Truro. Hi, Jane.
Hi. Don't Look Back. It's based on a Daphne du Maurier story. Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie back in the 70s, I think. Their daughter dies. I think she's wearing a yellow or red raincoat, and then they end up going to Venice and following this what they think is the ghost of their daughter, and there are psychics involved. Very Daphne du Maurier, very scary.
That sounds like an intense one, Jane.
It is.
I think Jenny and Dan have seen every movie. They're in there nodding their heads with all these films that we're saying, what are they? Jenny's nodding her head to that one, Jane. She says, good pick.
It's interesting how we enjoy being scared.
I know, right? Yeah. Jane, thanks for the call. You know, I like the Sixth Sense kind of scary, you know, that suspenseful thing. I don't like the Silence of the Lambs kind of scary thing. That stuff that just stays in your head and, like, you know, really... scary, creepy stuff. That stuff's a little too much for me. Mm-hmm. And the slasher movies, forget it.
Slasher
movies. I'm not even going
there. Yeah, well, I think Hitchcock prove that you can be extremely scary and suspenseful and really not show anything.
Right.
Yeah,
you
know, that's right.
Yeah.
And quite often that is much scarier. You hear footsteps behind you. You look around, you don't see anything. Well, what's scarier, doing that or looking around and seeing, like, you know, someone standing?
Monster,
So. Right.
And then, of course, we have a couple other suggestions here. The Three Faces. Somebody else suggested that.
Yeah.
A Dangerous Method, The Prince of Tides, Sybil. That's one we haven't said.
Well, The Prince of Tides, I thought, was like an outstanding book and also made a pretty good movie about that. Talks again about... Well, I wouldn't think it was an accurate depiction of what happens in psychotherapy. I certainly hope it's not an accurate depiction of what goes on. But that was, again, post-traumatic stress disorder and how people try and come to grips with that. And I would probably recommend the book over the movie because there's so many things. The movie would be 6 hours long. You could never do it.
I think Sybil was also made into a movie, a TV movie. I think Sally Field.
Yep, Sally Field was in that. Yep.
Yeah, it was All right, Leslie is giving us a call. I'm not sure from where, but hi, Leslie.
Hi, Yarmouth Port.
Oh, hi.
Two books. There's not enough books in this
Okay,
list.
Good.
Yes.
One of them is a recent book. It's called Billy Flynn's Long Halftime Walk, about a returning veteran from and his squad that comes back from Afghanistan and is on a so-called victory tour at a stadium in Texas. This shows the disconnect between the war actually as it was fought, and the war at home.
Mm-hmm.
The book won a National Books Critics Circle Award, but it is also called The Catch-22 of the Iraq War, and Catch-22 is another one. Both books with lots of psychological dimension.
You know, which,
how war makes you crazy. Basically.
Yeah, I was going to another good book, more recent, where is Sebastian Younger's War, where he goes into the Korngal Valley with, and it's amazing. These you know, this troop that he's with, you know, these guys want to sign up again, and they're doing like a dozen firefights a day. And you think, why would you want to go back there?
That's right.
But these, a lot of them, he was saying, you know, they have a purpose, and you know, when they go home, and then you know, it was a really fascinating look at you know, kind of what goes through their minds in these, in these really tense situations.
Addiction to to thrill.
Right. Yeah.
What happens to Billy Lynn is that his sister has a friend who can get him out.
Oh,
sort of let him go AWOL, and he doesn't want to go.
Right.
Oh, interesting.
Back.
Yeah. Right,
which,
good.
You know, it's crazy, but it's the camaraderie, I think, that he loves.
And, and the purpose, and the sense of purpose.
Yes.
You have a
yeah.
purpose,
We see a confluence of all those things, the purpose reinforced by the addictive quality, which is reinforced by the sense of purpose. Keeps you in there. It's a cycle you get caught up in.
Even though it's so illogical.
Yeah,
right.
Leslie, thanks for the call. Those are some good suggestions. Thanks for adding some books to the list. We had a caller who said Francis, about Francis Farmer with Jessica Lange. I did see that movie. It was a long time ago. I can't quite remember. You guys know that?
I haven't seen it recently.
Francis,
I saw it a long time ago, but I remember that Jessica Lange was also in a movie called Blue Sky, which I will recommend. It's probably an obscure film, and I'd be surprised if Dan had seen it.
I can't believe it.
But this is a really, she plays someone who has a potpourri of psychiatric diagnoses, but one of the benefits is she is fiercely loyal to her husband, and it takes place on a military base, and also depicts what happens when someone is involuntarily hospitalized, maybe in a system that is not as, well, hopefully not as kind as ours is. And it talks about her commitment to family and overcoming her seemingly extreme psychiatric problems. Mm-hmm. And a couple of scenes in there are really quite remarkable for how a person can overcome the obstacles of an extreme psychiatric diagnosis and really do some positive good trying to reclaim some of the damage they've done. So Blue Sky with Jessica Lange.
Mm-hmm. Okay. You know, you mentioned that, and there's one thing I want to mention about A Beautiful Mind, about how that, in terms of overcoming psychological damage. The scene at the end of that film where John Nash, the schizophrenic, is improved in his condition, and he is going forward to accept his Nobel Prize for the work he did in math. And it shows him walking through a courtyard or a hallway, and off to the side are all his imaginary tormentors, the ones that we by then know in the film that it was imaginary. All just there, not interacting with him, but just being present. And he just kind of nods his head, acknowledges them, and then goes on with his life. Mm-hmm. That depicted to me the goal of a lot of our treatment, that people are no longer dominated by mm-hmm. their demons. Mm-hmm. They still might have them.
Yeah.
We don't talk about cure in our field. The demons are still there, but they don't control, they don't dominate. And that's what really brought home such a visual impact on me on such a learning.
Right, I thought that was very well, example of having mm-hmm. it very well depicted, because it shows something that I think, as Mark referred to, people don't realize very much. People overcome these things.
That's mm-hmm. right.
You know, they have these conditions and they still manage to function. They walk and talk can do some extraordinary things.
Mm-hmm. Right.
As John Nash did.
Absolutely.
And that was based on a true story.
Well, not only that, but there was a very famous psychiatrist around the turn of the century. Harry Stack Sullivan was diagnosed with schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Major theorist around the turn of the century. Mm-hmm. Maybe the 1950s.
50s, yeah.
You know, on that. So clearly they can do amazing things.
Yeah, his description of schizophrenia is amazing.
Yes.
Right on.
Whatever Happened to Baby Jane? We used the clip. Wasn't that a great movie?
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Boy.
That
Betty Davis and Joan Crawford. It's what's going on here? That's one worth going back to see again if you have not seen it in a while. Another one that we had in the montage at the top was Fatal Attraction. That was a scary movie.
That was scary.
Yeah.
You
can sort of, in a way, go, Michael Douglas has no idea this is coming, and how it can really impact your life. Somebody who's a little off balance, Glenn Close's character was.
Right, that's true. That was a very good depiction too. Yeah. Exactly how she was. She was alternately very disturbed and very contrite, and very disturbed and very contrite. You don't know if it's like a temporary thing or a serious thing. You don't really know until it's way too late that it's much more deeply enduring than
it's a seductive thing. That's for sure.
Yeah.
And then you're too late.
Yeah, it was interesting because I was watching a scene from it yesterday as we were going through some of this stuff, and in that scene, that with a little bit of the clip we have, he storms out after, she's like, well, I'm not going to be ignored, so he tries to storm out, and she's like yelling about, I'll tell your wife, and then he gets mad and he shakes her, and then he storms out, and she's, I'm going to call your wife, and then it's like, oh, I'm sorry, don't go, and then she picks mm-hmm. up the phone, and then she, throws the phone. I mean, you really can see mm-hmm. the, mm-hmm. What she's going through, and it's, I thought, yikes, there's more to come on that.
Right.
All right. So in this article we have so many movies here that we really are not even being able to get to. What are some of the ones, big ones we're missing? Oh, we have Cheyenne says Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. Do you know that one?
I do.
Oh, you do?
I do have seen that.
And I don't know that one.
And that that was a Jim Carrey movie. And it basically involves a kind of, maybe in science fiction, a technology whereby if you really have a traumatic experience or unpleasant experience, you can go to Dr. So-and-so's laboratory, and he will put you under with some electrodes, and he will just make those memories go away, just like polishing them away so you don't remember. Hmm. And it shows what happens when you don't have that kind of memory. Hmm. And lo and behold, what tends to happen to most people, they go back and do the same thing again.
They
go back as though they were drawn to it. So it's very interesting, and I think Jim Carrey has a different kind of character in that.
Yeah.
But it really depicts what happens when you try and play around with someone else's mind without letting them know what's going on. That does not work out well.
Doesn't work out well. Well, on this list, we mentioned earlier this list that was put together for Psychology Today. I'm missing her name here. But Hamlet, Major Depressive Disorder.
Yes.
What are some of the other? Marty? Oh, that was a good film too, Marty.
Ernest Borgnine.
Thank you.
He got an Academy Award for that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that was a good one too. What are some of the favorites is there something that's really hit you when you've read or a film that really stands out as kind of a moment in time, like my book where I didn't go on a date for months? Something that impacted your how you responded to it in your own life? No.
Okay.
No? Okay. I guess I'm the only one. Okay. Well, we have an email that says, Wait Until Dark, Audrey Hepburn. Alan Arkin.
Yeah, and that, as I recall, that was, she is blind and being stalked by someone. I forget what the reason is on that. Again, a suspenseful, chilling kind of drama.
Mm-hmm. All right. Let's see. Girl Interrupted. That was a book and a movie. Mm-hmm. That was Angelina Jolie, and I think Winona Ryder was in that one as well.
Yes.
That was another. There's, I was mentioning Jack Nicholson earlier, who can really play those crazy parts as well. Angelina Jolie's another one. She can play those parts very believably.
Yeah. Well, I think it's always easier to play someone who has rather striking kinds of behavioral characteristics, because for someone who doesn't have them, you can just act over the top. You can be overly dramatic and mostly hit any kind of those dramatic scenes. But the people who really have these conditions, they're not acting.
Right.
They're not acting. It's really very difficult to live in their skin sometimes until they hit upon the right combination to help them overcome that.
Mm-hmm.
And the point is they have to keep on trying until they get the right combination of either therapy and medication so they can overcome these things, because living in their skin is sometimes very difficult for them.
Right. Sure. And I guess for us, watching these films, it gives us, as we say, some insight into what that might be like.
Yeah.
I was also thinking the performance that Angelina Jolie had in Girl Interrupted reminded me of a film she had done earlier, Gia. Did you ever see Gia?
Mm-hmm.
Gia was based on a true story. It was based on a supermodel who got involved with drugs and ended up contracting AIDS, and she died from AIDS. But she was a very intense character. So it really showed this kind of spiraling, drug addiction out of control and a sad ending to her life. But she did a great job in that film as well. That was one of those films that you watch and you go, okay, if you have daughters, she is not going into the modeling business.
Let's talk about No Country for Old Men.
Oh, no, we didn't ask
see that.
I thought
that was really a... I would have to admit, if I was critiquing the book, I would not like what the author did to his characters. But of course, the striking performances by the actors. I would probably go along with the suggestion that that would be antisocial personality disorder, maybe a few other things by the bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
And again, a very chilling depiction of what happens when things can just go wrong so badly, even among bad guys and innocent bystanders.
Yeah.
So, in people who don't know, one of the characters early on stumbles across an injury or a murder scene, and then decides to go back to help the person, and then things get very bad for his family, and everyone knows it just rolls out of control.
Getting back to that article about the Oscar winners and the statistics about it, the frequent psychological disorders that were depicted were both antisocial personality disorder and narcissistic personality disorder, which are really very – there's a lot of overlap between those two. They both are based on self-centeredness. Mm-hmm. I guess almost half the movies that got awards had to do with that. Raises the question, why are we so interested in self-centeredness? Why do we find it so attractive to spend our money and go watch?
And does it happen as much in real life as it does in the movies?
Right. Well, we're drawn to these people is what it is, I think. And because they express what we inhibit in ourselves, because we're socialized to, care for one another, be polite, et cetera. And these people get away with it.
Yeah. Hi. Jamie from Orleans. Let's squeeze Jamie in.
Hi,
Jamie. Hi, go ahead, Jamie.
Yeah.
Yep.
I was thinking of The Uninvited and possibly even Sucker Punch.
The Uninvited and Sucker Punch. I'm not familiar with either one of those. The Uninvited.
It was with Emily Browning, and she was in the hospital for mental stuff, and she got out, and it was because of, crazy stuff going at home with her dad and a stepmom and the death of her mother.
Mm.
And she thinks that she sees her sister. And it really
intense.
Makes you think.
Okay. Good.
That sounds very interesting.
Yeah.
Very
Jamie, interesting. Thanks for...
Okay, thanks.
Yeah.
It reminded me of, A Beautiful Mind, kind of.
Oh, right.
Okay.
Good. All right. We're going to have to check that one out then.
Yeah.
All right. Jamie, thanks for adding to the list. We appreciate that. We got about a minute left or so. So really what this all boils down to is, as we started the beginning talking about, we're visual people.
Yeah.
And, this is how we, empathize and learn about.
And connect with one another. Yeah. I have quite a list, Netflix list for myself here.
I've been jotting down some of these myself.
In addition to what we talk about, the visual aspect, it's more of a visceral aspect. We relate on a number of different areas, but the important thing to remember is that for people who don't know, they can get some understanding of what's going on with this, with these conditions as we look at them, and help educate not only ourselves to what might be going on we don't understand, but for some people it could help educate them as to what's going on with them when they recognize themselves and say, oh, wow, so that's why.
That looks familiar.
I wonder if I might have that too. Maybe go and try and get that out.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
All right, Jenny has some advice for you. She says, don't watch them all in a row. You might go crazy, too.
Thanks.
Psychiatrist Mark Whaley, psychologist Michael Abbruzzese, thank you both.
Thank you very much.
I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
Amy Vins produces The Point, with assistance from Jenny Junker. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter. The Point is a production of the Cape and Islands NPR stations, a service of WGBH.